There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots, independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesvanel. I'm your host. Producer Drew Tirico is on hiatus. On today's program, podcasting and the many shades of independent media, and pirates making waves in Tucson, Arizona. We'll continue our conversation with Evan Henshaw-Blath from Odeo.com, a new web-based podcasting application. We'll talk about how podcasting and other new web technologies work together with independent media. We'll also have an encore playback of an interview with Michael Leahy, the documentarian behind Making Waves, which is about the interesting pirate radio scene that was in Tucson, Arizona. All this, we'll catch up with a little bit of Media Geek news. Do stay tuned. On Monday, July 25th, New York State Attorney General Elliot Spitzer confirmed what almost any commercial radio listener could figure out, that the songs played are not chosen based on artistic merit, but are bought and paid for by the record labels. Attorney General Spitzer announced a settlement with Sony BMG Music, wherein the label admitted to paying radio stations, programmers, and DJs with money and gifts in exchange for airplay. Sony BMG agreed to end the practice known as payola and to make a $10 million payment to not-for-profit groups that fund programs for music education and appreciation in New York State. According to the Attorney General's office, some of the payola practices uncovered include outright bribes to radio programmers, including expensive vacation packages, electronics and other valuable items, contest giveaways for stations' listening audiences, payments to radio stations to cover operational expenses, and retention of middlemen, known as independent promoters, as conduits for illegal payments to radio stations. The Attorney General's office also released documents, including internal company emails, that demonstrate these practices. In discussing a bribe given to a radio programmer in Buffalo, New York, one promotion executive at Sony BMG's Epic Records wrote an email to another colleague at Epic. It says, quote, 2 weeks ago, it cost us over $4,000 to get Franz Ferdinand on WKSE. That is what the four trips to Miami and hotel cost. At the end of the day, Universal added Good Charlotte and Gretchen Wilson and hit Alex up for another grand, and they settled for $750. So almost $5,000 in 2 weeks for overnight airplay. Spitzer told a press conference that the case against Sony BMG is just the beginning. His office is also investigating the other major labels, including Universal Music Group, EMI, and Warner Music Group. The Attorney General is also targeting the nation's largest radio broadcasters, including Clear Channel and Infinity, who have allegedly benefited financially from payola. Spitzer also singled out the Federal Communications Commission for criticism because that agency has apparently done nothing to address the rampant problem of payola in radio. He told reporters, quote, I would certainly encourage the FCC to take a hard look at whether something that is this pervasive, something that is so corrosive to the marketplace, should not merely be investigated and pursued, but whether some of these stations deserve to have their licenses stripped from them, end quote. In a press release, Democratic FCC Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein said that he is calling for an FCC investigation into radio payola. The uncovering of this growing payola scandal has also begun to reverberate in Congress. Democratic Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin said that news of the Sony BMG payola settlement renews the need for Congress to readdress issues of payola, quote, combined with increasing concentration and vertical integration in the radio industry, end quote. In 2003, Feingold introduced a bill, the Competition in Radio and Concert Industries Act, that was intended to address payola practices in the music industry. It is likely that he will press to introduce new similar legislation. Further, there is growing indications that payola and radio ownership will become bargaining chips in the upcoming 2006 rewrite of the Telecommunications Act. And that's some of what's going on in our media environment this past week. You're listening to Media Geek. Check us out online at www.mediageek.org, where you can get the Media Geek blog full of news and opinions and information that can't quite make it onto the program, as well as archive editions of the program in MP3 in the open source Ogg Vorbis format, including our podcast feed. Send along comments to me, Paul, at mediageek.org. Coming up in just a moment, podcasting and indie media. We'll continue our conversation with Evan Henshaw Plath. Do stay tuned. Evan Henshaw Plath is a developer for Odeo.com, that's O-D-E-O.com, a new podcasting application that's on the web that helps people both produce webcasts and easily aggregate, download, and listen to podcasts. But Evan also has a pretty lengthy independent media resume. He's been involved with indie media pretty much since the beginning in 1999 when the network first came to the fore during the protests against the WTO in Seattle. Last week, we talked to Evan about Odeo.com. This week, we're going to extend the conversation a little bit as we talk more about how podcasting and other interesting media innovations online work together with independent media.
There's a lot of, you hear a lot of talk on the internet, or you read a lot of talk on the internet about democratizing tools for communication and about so-called citizen journalism, with a lot of efforts out there. And you hear that Google is getting into hosting video for people, and a lot of other companies are doing this. And then companies like Odeo are offering things. Is there a risk at all that for-profit measures are co-opting some of the rhetoric of indie media, which is a more radical enterprise, perhaps even at the expense of efforts like indie media?
Sure, there's definitely some co-option going on, and I have mixed feelings about it. Sometimes I say, "Wow, this is great that our ideas." You look at the original, principles of unity, you look at some of the statements of purpose that came behind the media, and you see elements of that in all of these much more mainstream citizen journalism programs and ideas that are coming out of Silicon Valley. At the same time, there's something fundamentally missing in the Silicon Valley vision of participatory journalism. It's not tied into a political message. It's not tied into social movements. It's us as individuals creating media as opposed to creating media for social justice. Mm-hmm. And it's not conceived of as a collective project. And that's where indie media really sticks out. And I say indie media in the broader sense that it also includes, local radical newspapers and radio stations and media centers where people can go and get online. All of those projects are about taking these media tools and providing them as a way of achieving social justice, whereas much of the citizen journalism stuff that's been popular in the last year is much more just getting away from the paid corporate reporter, but not getting to the idea that this is specifically for social justice. Now, the tools that get created when you have more resources are useful to then take back to the indie media community, and are useful when we take them back to pirate radio stations and we take them back to protesters. But it's sort of a back and forth, and yeah, there's some appropriation going on there. I don't know the answer.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you blog yourself in addition to your intermediate work at anarchogeek.com.
Yep.
And I know one of the things that you've taken up on many occasions is the notion of technological innovation in independent media.
Yep.
You know, and certainly it seems like something like Odeo is an area where you're working on technological innovation in a lot of ways. The first indie media site in 1999 pioneered really the ability for citizens or you know, individuals to upload audio and video and pictures and text on their own to the internet. But you've also sort of, it seems like you've been a little critical of, or noticed some stagnation in that area, in indie media.
Well, I feel like when, for the first couple of years, indie media was pretty innovative, and it said that we're going to open this up and we're going to rethink what's happening, and we're going to make this open publishing, and it was a very powerful statement. But part of what happened was we got stuck on one way of doing it. We got stuck on one way of doing participatory online media. And we stopped innovating. And we stopped sort of being able to push the envelope. And our ideas then got taken over and adopted by other people, in that there should be citizen journalists, there should be participatory media. But they lost some of the political aspect of it. What we need to do is figure out how do we take the ideas. You know, there are new ways of organizing information online. It's not just categories. There's new ways of organizing how people publish. There's new ways of doing editing. When indie media started, there weren't wikis. There weren't tag-based information organization systems. There weren't the concepts of the kind of collaborative editing that we now see being pushed forward. And so what we need to do in indie media is we need to say, okay, well, these are new ideas, these are new things, let's take them back, and let's push forward with these new systems, incorporating them into what we do.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't done that yet. But I feel like that there's enough energy within the indie media movement of saying, okay, well, we need to have websites that look nice. And it's not corporate to make a website that looks nice and is easy to use. It's not corporate to have a white background because it's easier for people to see. We need to have websites that organize the information well. We need to include the concept of wikis. We need to include the concepts of a bottom-up information organization instead of a top-down category-based hierarchy. We need to include more active syndication. Indie media uses syndication, which is taking content from one website to another, a lot internally within the indie media network, but we don't reach out and really share it with the rest of the media activist world. The Odeo directory is all based on syndication. It's all content pulled from all sorts of parts of the internet and created into a single directory. And that's the kind of thing that we should be doing within the media. But the techies and the software developers have been dragged into chasing the latest protest only.
Mm-hmm.
At sometimes at the expense of pushing forward innovation. You know, and I've certainly been to my share of major anti-globalization protests, and they're a lot of fun, but we need to figure out how to continue that development and continue that innovation in other spaces.
And I've definitely seen lots of indie media people, especially in North America, using Odeo, using tools like Flickr for photos and organizing and sharing and tagging photos.
Yeah.
Is there a risk there at all that by going to these for-profit tools that, you know, like Flickr can be bought by Yahoo and maybe changed as a result? Is that a risk for the folks doing indie media work where we might lose control over what we do?
In some ways it's a risk. In some ways it's a reaction to people saying, well, we need to be using these tools. We need to be embracing them. We need to be taking it up. I know the New York City Indie Media Center uses a lot of blogs from a company called Movable Type, which is another one of these San Francisco companies. And so in some way, I say, how could they be doing this? We need to be creating our own stuff. On another level, we need to be using out what's out there and what's innovative. And then we should be figuring out how we build it so we can roll it back in. there are ways using web services that we could be publishing stuff into Flickr, but then presenting it in a more political context where people are able to get additional information. So it's not simply a protest, a photo of a protester getting beaten up by a cop, but you have the surrounding information where you can understand and learn the context of the protest. You can understand and learn the background behind police brutality. And what we can lose in just using the corporate tools is that context and connection. So you can have a radical podcast and it can be in the audio directory, but if it's only in the audio directory and it doesn't exist with a website and it doesn't exist with more information and connected to the media, then it loses the political context, which makes it a more profound act.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I really agree with you there. And I mean, for myself in doing the Media Geek radio show, which is not a specifically indie media project, but which I work within that model in a lot of ways. You know, I upload it to many different places like Radio for All. I also make sure it's available on Radio Indie Media. In addition, it's now, thanks to you, available over at Odeo and also, I think probably due to Odeo, I don't know how, it's available on the iTunes Music Store. But yeah. I think it's important, one, to have it, those connections, and I have my own website, which is hosted here in a local community server, and helps to direct people to all these different things, because just on its own, it even with the content being what it is, it could be a bit decontextualized, and it's hard to connect it up with a larger set of phenomena, which is beyond just simple podcasting. Which in and of itself isn't necessarily particularly political, and in some ways could be somewhat apolitical since it is just a tool.
Yeah, and you look at what people are using podcasting for, and some people are using it for political purposes, but a lot aren't.
Mm-hmm.
And any kind of participatory media is going to reflect the community that's participating. And the kinds of people who have first jumped onto blogging and jumped onto podcasting tend to be privileged, upper middle class, more men than women, more white people than minorities. And so you can say, wow, look at those people, it's a really apolitical community. Or you can say, look, there's some tools we can appropriate, some things we can do which really reach out and make this a political tool, make this an active, subversive form of media.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only when it exists within an environment. Like one particular, no one radio show or photo gallery or article is ever going to be enough to change the world. What changes it is the environment and the context which many of these things can be produced and understood.
And that was Evan Henshaw Plath of Odeo.com. He also has his own weblog at anarchogeek.com. That's anarchogeek.com. And now we turn to the world of pirate radio. Last November, we played an interview with Michael Leahy, who is an independent documentarian now living in Minneapolis, Minnesota, but who lived in Tucson, Arizona for a time and produced a documentary called Making Waves about the very interesting pirate radio scene that was going on in that city just a few years ago. I had the luck to meet up with Michael at a conference called Radio Access Democracy, where his film was played. And here's a bit of that interview.
Coming to a transmitter near you.
Somewhere in the ballpark of, 2,500 radio stations like this have cropped up all over the country.
Arr, pirate radio in the house.
Your film, Making Waves, is about some unlicensed radio operators in Tucson, Arizona. Can you tell me a little bit more about the stations that you focus on?
Sure. There were three stations that were operating unlicensed simultaneously in 2000, which is when I started this project. The main station that I focused on, KRVL, was a station that was very much in the open, unlike a lot of the more clandestine pirate radio stations. They were giving out where they were on the air. They had a huge sign in front of building that said, it was a quote from Thomas Jefferson, never trust your government, tune into 94.3 FM. So that was the main station that I focused on, and I found them to be very interesting in the fact that they weren't hiding and that this was going to come to a head in some way, I felt. I didn't know how that was going to be. Either is the FCC going to come and shut them down? Are they going to get a big enough following that even if the FCC does come, it will be moot, or maybe the community can take a hold? Or will they be unable to sustain it and implode? Those were kind of the three options with them. Through KRVL, I found that there was another station that was open, that was operating in the open, and that was KOPC, which was also called Free Radio Tucson. And they were another station that was in the open, but they weren't giving out their address of where they were at. Although, if you went by the house and saw the gigantic antenna coming out from it, it didn't look like your normal little rabbit ears or, you know, antenna going on there. And then the third station was Radio Limbo, which I had been listening to for several years, and they operated in the, I guess, for lack of a better term, the typical clandestine type of hiding from the FCC, moving the transmitter from place to place. And so one station led to the others, and I just started seeing what was going to happen with these guys.
You're listening to Freedom Radio, 94.3 FM.
You're listening to Free Radio Tucson, free speech for the Southwest.
So why did you decide to make a documentary about them?
Well, initially, the term, I had never even heard the term low power radio before, or micro radio. I had heard only pirate radio. And my initial impetus for the documentary was Shane Eden, who was a public access celebrity, so to speak. He had had a show running for 16 years. That had originally started as kind of a variety show and had then morphed into a what he would call a constitutional patriot type of hour-long program. And I had heard about him, had met him, thought he was an interesting character. He happens to look a lot like Santa Claus, so he was interesting. I thought in front of the camera he would look quite good, and he had taped all of his shows for 16 years. So I thought that maybe a compilation film would be interesting about him. But then he also was running this unlicensed radio station, which was KRVL that I mentioned earlier. And when he told me about the station, he said, you should tune in. And I started listening to it, and it was unlike just about any other station I had heard before. This was just before the 2000 election. And although there was political media that was being played, you know, almost the whole time on there, none of it had to do with Bush or Gore. And it was mostly talking about individual rights. It was talking about the Constitution. It was talking about issues of sovereignty. And these were issues that I had heard very little of my whole life. And I thought, this is an interesting group, and what would they be interested in an election year? After that, I just kind of became more about the micro-radio movement.
Keep it right there. You're listening to 94.3 FM, Your Rights Radio Without Licensing. The goal of this radio station is to help draw people out of poverty consciousness and into greater affluence. Out of violence and into something more peaceful. Out of injustice and into something more tolerant. The Arizona Constitution says the purpose of Arizona government is to protect and maintain individual rights. Do you know what your individual rights are? Keep listening.
So the film is about the micro-radio movement, but it's really told through the story, especially of this one station, But and in the other stations in Tucson, right?
Right. Yes, KRVL is kind of the main. They're kind of the test case. You get to see them from start to finish. What was the inception? What were the dynamic? Because they split with Free Radio Tucson, and what were the issues that caused them to split? And then you get to see them try to recruit the technical issues that they have to fight through. How they are they building a following, and then ultimately what happens to the station. And in between there, of course, a visit from the FCC. So you get to see more of this station because they had kind of the full arc during the time that I was filming, which lasted about 10 months. The other stations are used more as supplemental stations to see some diversity, because I try to contrast with Radio Limbo, which was the clandestine station, of how they operate, what they really were apolitical in a certain sense. I mean, the music that they played was clearly, I would say, had messages that were, you know, anti-corporate and that kind of thing. But overall, I think that they were in stark contrast to the way that KRVL was operating. It certainly raises the issue during the course of the film of what's the better route. And, you know, by being out in the open, did that ultimately help KRVL or did it hurt them? And with Limbo being hidden, did that ultimately extend their life?
Right. And KRVL is not only out in the open, but they, you know, with this very sharp focus on individual rights and constitutional rights, I mean, they do so, they're out in the open because they want to make that statement.
Right. Right. And I think one of the things that drew me to this is that not just this group, but this group in particular, lived largely in a world of abstraction before they took on the radio station. In other words, they talk about that there's this huge disconnect between the original tenets of the Constitution and where our laws are today. And what I thought was interesting is through two examples. One was through the radio station, and the other was through Marshall Holm, one of the main characters. He does not use a driver's license or a license plate on his car. And those two examples provide the viewer with the way that they took their abstract views and actually put them out in the open. And one of the things I was curious about is how will this play out? In other words, will the public accept it? And Marshall even asked that question during the course of the film. Or will the public reject it, you know, without giving the film away? I think that the internal factors proved surprisingly more of a impedance than the external factors.
And that was filmmaker Michael Leahy talking about his documentary on the Tucson pirate radio scene, Making Waves. For more information about that film, look online to jumpcutfilms.com. That's jumpcutfilms.com. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. We'll be back in 1 week with more news and views on our media environment. In the meantime, check out Media Geek on the web at www.mediageek.org. There you can read the Media Geek blog for news that can't fit onto the show, as well as download archive episodes of the program in MP3 in the open source Ogg Vorbis format. If you have any comments about the program, please send them to paul@mediageek.org. I'm host and executive producer Paul Riesmandel. Our producer is Drew Tirico. Media Geek is produced live at community radio station WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. Some pre-production happens at the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center. Media Geek is also heard on KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, and on KQRP in Salida, California. And Media Geek is free to broadcast on your local non-commercial station, too. To inquire, please send email to paul@mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.